Winds in the east, mist coming in, like something is brewing, about to begin. Can't put me finger on what lies in store, but I feel what's to happen, all happened before.
Oh, it's you. Hello. Number 17 Cherry Tree Lane, you say? All right. Come along with me.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Movie Palace. As ever, I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and thanks for joining me again this week. And this is our Christmas special episode. It's our last podcast of the year, last episode of season one of the Movie Palace, essentially. And it's designed basically to tie in with a new film that, by the time you hear this, I think this film will have just hit cinemas. So the new film is Mary Poppins Returns. So we thought it'd be appropriate this week to talk all about Mary Poppins from 1964, starring Julie Andrews and Dick Van Dyke. And I'm joined by two guests. So, first of all, a man you may remember from such episodes as Singing in the Rain and Night of the Hunter, Mr. Tony Black. Hi, Tony.
I'm singing in the rain. I'm singing... Oh, sorry, Governor, wrong podcast. Hello, how are you doing?
That's terrible. It's getting worse. My Dick Van Dyke is getting worse. Like, the more I... Yeah, anyway, I've just had a text from my wife from the other room saying, what are you doing? And who's going to listen to this? It's a good question, really, so, you know.
I think Dick Van Dyke set the bar quite low with his accent, but you're still struggling to get there, aren't you? But, I appreciate the effort.
Oh, anyway. Thanks. Yeah, it's nice to be back on the Movie Palace.
No, it's good to talk to you again, definitely. And Tony and I are joined by one of our closest podcasting friends, I think, but it's her first appearance on the Movie Palace. And her name is Sarah Blair. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. I've been practicing my Mary Poppins, but not too great at it.
Sarah, it's such a pleasure to have you on the podcast finally, because you and me and Tony, we all know each other from the X-Cast, of course. And but first time for a while the three of us have recorded together, and the first time on this show. So, yep, really looking forward to this one.
Yeah, the last time we did it, it was a live 24-hour podcast, and I was probably like half asleep or eating dinner at the time, because I've been recording, yeah, for like a whole day. So it's nice to actually do one when I'm not like about to die of, like, you know, exhaustion. So
yes, I've been looking forward to this one for a while, you guys.
Yeah, me too. And it's extra special, I think, because we're so close to Christmas. And I was just wondering about you guys. I mean, I just assume you're both big, you know, Christmas fans, you know, big, very festive people, but I don't quite know. So, Sarah, what does Christmas mean to you?
Oh, I like eggnog and the lights, the twinkle lights are great. I always liked it more as a kid, I think, than as an adult. I feel like now that I'm grown up, there's a lot more stress around the holidays. But, you know, it's fun now that I've got kids and I like to entertain them, and it's more fun to relive it through their eyes, I think, these days. But yeah.
Yeah. I think I enjoy it more and more the older I get, actually. I'm getting more and more sentimental each year. So Christmas is always a favourite time of year for me. How about you, Tony?
Yeah. You can't beat Christmas. You get time off work. You know, that's the best thing about it. And it's a nice period. It's different when you're an adult, obviously, because you don't have all the, you do get presents, but it's not, when you're a kid, the presents are like the most amazing thing in the world, because you don't get that any other time of the year. Now, yeah. I can buy what I want on Amazon every 5 minutes, you know, it's not, but so it's not about that. It's the feeling of family and that special time of year. And also it's the little, somebody said this to me once and it's always stuck with me. It's the point of the year where you just go, oh, I made it. I got through another one. Yeah. And you just breathe a sigh of relief and enjoy it and relax. So, yeah, it's a great time of year. It's cold, though. It's really cold. Where we live, Sarah, I think where the Christmases are nice and warm for you, but they are freezing in the UK.
Yeah, hopefully. I'm going to predict a white Christmas for the UK this year.
Are you dreaming of it, Cole?
I am. I mean, for me, Christmas, a lot of it's about, you know, about films, really. It's a time of year when I end up watching a lot of films with family, you know, during the year off and doing our own things or whatever. But Christmas, you're forced to spend time with your family, basically. And
forced being the key word there. Good word.
Forced. maybe not the best choice of verb. But yeah, and a lot of time watching films. I mean, what's your favourite Christmas movie? And you can define that however you want. Like, either a film about Christmas or something like Mary Poppins, I guess, would be a film that I associate with Christmas. I think you said you do too, Tony, because it seemed to be a fixture in the Christmas like TV listings over here anyway. But yeah, what's your favourite Christmas movie and for whatever reason?
Yeah, Mary Poppins does feel like a Christmas film in a weird way, even though it's not set at Christmas. It's always on. In fact, it's usually on New Year's Day, actually, weirdly enough. And I suppose it's that sort of boost into, you know, the new year in the UK, certainly in the UK, you know, that nice feeling as you go into a new year. But yeah, I think my favourite Christmas film, I think it veers between two. I think if the child in me, it's Santa Claus the movie, which, when I watched it last year, and it's not a very good film, really, in many ways. But that film so takes me back to my childhood. It takes me back to like 5 years old with all the, you know, the candy, glowing candy cane things, and Dudley Moore as an elf, and John Lithgow being evil, and all this kind of thing. But I think as an adult, I probably would say A Muppet Christmas Carol, which is the best Christmas Carol adaptation ever. Although I do love, the one I love, oddly enough, it's not like the Alistair Sim stuff. It's the one with Patrick Stewart, which was a TV movie.
Yeah.
That is fantastic, that one. I love that. But you can't beat a bit of Muppet's Christmas Carol and a nice little sing-along at the end.
Yeah, well, I was going to give a slightly wishy-washy answer, which is like, my favourite is not one individual film, but I always make time, you know, every single year, to watch some kind of version of A Christmas Carol, which I think Dickens' original is the ultimate Christmas story, I think.
Yeah.
And it's like you said, I like the Patrick Stewart one. I think there's one with Kelsey Grammer I've seen, and the Muppets, of course, and the older versions. But it's such a durable story that it's hard to do it badly, I think. I mean, even, you know, there's the one with Bill Murray where it's kind of updated and
Scrooged,
stuff like that.
Scrooged, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But its influence reaches far and wide, doesn't it? Because there's all sorts of other things where, things like It's a Wonderful Life or The Grinch, where they're heavily inspired by A Christmas Carol, even though they're not a direct retelling. So, yeah, that would be my answer. Some version of A Christmas Carol.
I think it's the best story ever made. I think it's the best story ever written, genuinely. I've always thought this. I don't think you can beat A Christmas Carol for an arc of a character and a story. And there is a link to Mary Poppins with that, and I'll get to that in a bit. But like, yeah, definitely, there is a bit of Christmas Carol in Mary Poppins for sure.
And if anyone's a bit apprehensive about like reading Dickens or whatever, Christmas Carol's really short. I'd really recommend having a crack at it. And how about you, Sarah? What are your favourites, or what is your favourite?
Oh, well, my must-see every year, I have to put on Home Alone. I can't get through Christmas without Home Alone. Just the music, the score, John Williams did such a great job with that. I'll even listen to the soundtrack without even watching the movie just to feel like it's Christmas. That and the original Grinch, How the Grinch Stole Christmas, and Charlie Brown Christmas. I'm just like all about the classics, but yeah.
Yeah.
Those are my must see, but definitely Home Alone.
Is this a bad time to tell you, Sarah, that I'm going to see Home Alone with a live orchestra at the Royal Albert Hall in London at Christmas?
Can I come?
I'd happily give you. I get to go for free as well. This is a real smug. It's a real smug. Stop now. Sorry.
Just dig in the knife there, Tony.
Yeah, sorry. It's a great film. Yeah, it's a good choice.
That sounds awesome. Have fun.
Thanks. I don't know what else to say without sounding really smug.
And well, Home Alone 2, doesn't that have an early film appearance by the now President of the United States? Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Moving swiftly on.
I think we all try to blank that out of our minds now, don't we?
What about Disney then? I mean, I suppose if I was to make a bit of a tenuous link, I'd say, you know, Disney films often on the TV over Christmas as well. But I mean, we're here to talk about Mary Poppins, which is arguably one of Disney's greatest achievements. I mean, it was a film that was a massive commercial success, big acclaim within the film industry. You know, it had 13 Oscar nominations, including Best Picture, 5 wins, including Best Actress for Julie Andrews. Also a film that Walt Disney himself was heavily involved with, you know, released just a couple of years, I think, before his death, actually. But what about Disney generally? And again, you can take this however you want, whether you want to think about the man or the company as a whole or their output or whatever. But are you Disney fans? Sarah, do you want to take this first?
Yes. I love Disney, and I have since I was a kid. I think I went to Disneyland the first time when I was 3, and then again with my son when he was 3. So that was really cool. And, I mean, they just know how to create the atmosphere of magic, and it's really about the atmosphere and just how it makes you feel like anything is possible, and just about, it's like about dreams and wishes and hopes, and, you know, I just love the whole feeling surrounding Disney. It's just really, they make films for adults and kids to enjoy together, and there's something in it for everyone. I mean, I was just watching Incredibles 2 with my son last night. We were snuggled up, and there are things that I enjoyed about it, there's things that he enjoyed about it, and things that we both enjoyed. And, you know, I just love how it incorporates family, and it's something that you can make memories with, and it's just a great feel-good thing. I mean, especially Mary Poppins, like, I used to watch it as a kid, now I get to watch it with my kids. It's something that you can pass down and down and down. It's awesome.
So, very pro-Disney there. Yeah. Do you echo those thoughts, Tony?
Yeah, I'd say so. I'd say so. I think Sarah puts that really well, actually, in that they are... I mean, I think you'd be hard-pushed to find anyone in the Western world, and maybe even beyond that, who doesn't love at least one Disney movie. You know, bear in mind the fact that Disney, as an entity, have been going for, you know, the run of the majority of cinema, you know, now, really, since, like, the early sort of cartoons in the, I think, the 30s and 40s, and things like... you know, or building up into some classic ones they did in the 60s, like, you know, the Jungle Book and the Robin Hood and all that kind of thing. And then moving into live action with, obviously, Mary Poppins and things like Bedknobs and Broomsticks, which is another favourite of mine. And then, really, it's the brand, you know, it goes beyond the man. I think Walt Disney died in, like, the late 1960s or something like that. And, you know, the brand has just now become, you know, Sarah mentioned Incredibles too. I mean, you've now got a brand that includes Pixar, you've got a brand that includes Marvel, you've got a brand that includes Lucasfilm, you know. So you Disney now is everything. Disney is cinema, really. And I think it kind of, in a way, always has been. I think it is generational, it does pass down. I mean, some of my favourites are the Herbie movies.
Yes.
I grew up. I love the Herbie films. Yeah. Carly, if we don't do the Love Bug at one point, then I'm not coming back on the show again. Right? Like, it's just great. So
yeah.
Yeah.
I was obsessed with the Gnome Mobile. Do you remember that one?
The what?
The Gnome Mobile.
The Gnome Mobile. No, I've not heard of that one.
Oh, I think it's got the same girl that plays Jane and Mary Poppins. Oh. I think, I don't know if it's the same boy. It might be the same. Two kids. Yeah.
Well, guys, in the interests of balance, I feel compelled to state the anti-Disney case, to be honest, because...
Bah humbug, Sweeney. Yeah, humbug.
I will be honest and say I'm a bit of a Disney skeptic, all right? So some of their films I admire a lot, and like some of my favourites of their older films with things like Snow White and Pinocchio and Dumbo, I really like those. Mary Poppins, we'll talk about. I really like Mary Poppins. But you can critique Disney films in a lot of ways, I think. I was just reading a book called Deconstructing Disney by Eleanor Byrne and Martin McQuillan, and they summarise it this way. All right, so Tony Black, see what you make of this charge sheet, all right?
Go on, then.
The most frequent criticisms include sexism, racism, conservatism, heterosexism, androcentricism, cultural and economic imperialism, literary vandalism, jingoism, aberrant sexuality, censorship, propaganda, paranoia, homophobia, exploitation, ecological devastation, anti-union repression, FBI collaboration, corporate raiding, and stereotyping. So I think some of those would refer directly to Walt Disney himself. Some of them are about the films.
Yes, but sorry, Carl. Herbie is a talking, not a talking, Herbie is a living car that can, like, you know, help people and makes funny beat noises and, you know, so that invalidates the argument, to be honest. You know, the existence of Herbie counteracts all that for me. Sorry. The magic of Herbie.
Yeah, I think the love bug's a funny one, because I think that came after Walt Disney's death, didn't it? And the company was kind of in transition. And
no, do you know what? That is fair enough. You know, it is fair enough. There's a lot of stuff, if you look into Disney, that there's a lot of unsavory stuff. So yeah, I can't disagree with it. But wow, those people have got no joy in their lives, have they?
Yeah. Well, actually, that book, they were kind of they were looking at some of the newer stuff, and they were sort of saying that you have to kind of appraise some of the newer stuff differently. But I mean, you could say, when you think of the older films, you can say they reflect the times they were made in. Or you could take the other view, which is like, you could argue that they helped shape the times they were made in, you know, like Walt Disney was a very powerful man, you know. But no, I definitely don't, you know, I understand why people love these films. I really do. There's lots to enjoy. Enjoying them wholeheartedly doesn't mean you like fully sign up to the stereotyping or the sexism or whatever. It doesn't mean that, I don't think. I mean, for example, I know like Tony, you and I are big fans of like the James Bond films, for example. Mm. We're fully aware of the myriad of issues like around those films, aren't we? And you know, you can apply that to all sorts of things.
I think though, with something like Disney, and you know, you can do that parallel with, say, James Bond, is that you can, the majority of people obviously don't read a lot of stuff, and I don't mean this in a patronizing way, but they don't read a lot of things on multiple levels, really. A lot of people will read the surface, and they will read the, you know, what is presented in the presentation. And a lot of these films, you know, the Disney films do have that level of magic and creativity and things like that, that people are receptors to, and they take on board. So it's one of those things, whether it would mean different things to people who look at movies and look at cinema and look at culture, which is what we do, you know, differently. But it's the whole thing, I suppose, of separating the art from the people making it, and the, you know, everything like that. It's a difficult one.
I mean, everything is a product of its time, too. So things that we learn now and understand better today are not going to be able to be applied to the past and films that are made, you know, 20, 50 years ago, more than that even. So, yeah, I mean, I got a lecture from my dad. We got in the car after we saw Pocahontas in the 90s, and he's, like, giving me a lecture about how, you know, spirits don't make trees talk, and you know that's not real. I'm like, okay, but it's a movie, you know. So, I mean, and I, like, even as a 10-year-old, I knew better, and that's, like, the Native American culture was being represented, and that was actually a good thing, but that's a whole other story. But yeah, so I mean, I don't think that it's a reason to slam Disney movies, but everybody's got their own things that they're particular about. So it covers such a wide variety of cultures and time periods and everything else that I'm sure you could find something wrong with anything if you look hard enough.
Yeah, I'm closer to these writers, I think, than I am to you two. But I think it's fair enough. And I think that what you say is right about the times changing and stuff, but there are Disney films like Song of the South, for example, which were like controversial upon release, you know.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I'm a bit wary of giving Uncle Walt too much of a, you know, too much of a pass. But moving on, because Mary Poppins is calling. And I mean, the reason we're covering this now, I think this might have been one we covered like next year. But it's just such a neat tie-in to do this around the same time as Mary Poppins Returns comes out, which it depends where people are listening, but it may just have been released into cinemas in the last few days if you're in like the US and the UK, for example. And we're pre-recording this, aren't we? So we haven't, I don't think, seen any reviews yet.
No.
I mean, I've only seen a trailer. What do you guys think of the trailer? I assume you two have both seen it, but I don't know. Have you seen the trailer? Have you seen much about the kind of the buzz about this film?
I watched it again last night. I remember the first time I saw it when it first came out, and I was so excited. I mean, it brings tears to my eyes. I can't wait. I can't wait to see it. I think it's going to be great.
Yeah. I mean, I like Emily Blunt generally, but I'm not sure about her just from the little snippets I've seen so far, but I'm going to reserve judgment. But what do you make of it, Tony?
I like the trailer. It's hard to say. I mean, it's one of those sequels that is, for so long, would have been impossible to imagine. And in a way, it almost is impossible to imagine. It's impossible to imagine anyone except Julie Andrews as Mary Poppins. So I think Emily Blunt is a good actress, and I kind of think she's potentially got that sort of clipped, matronly yet kindly British thing going on, and I think she could probably do it. it's a real unknown entity. You know, I mean, the only worry I've got is the director, because I'm not the biggest fan of Rob Marshall, really. I don't dislike him as such, but I think most of his movies are very average. So we'll see. I've got a lot of high hopes, and I will go into it with a lot of positivity, wanting it to be good, because I do.
Yeah, I think we all do, and it's weird, isn't it? Because it must be one of the longest gaps between a film and its sequel that ever has been. I think I read that Bambi and Bambi 2 had a longer gap. Bambi 2 was like straight to video or something, so maybe it's not exactly comparable. But other than that, yeah, it's up there anyway. And fingers crossed, I suppose, Sarah, isn't it? Fingers crossed on this one.
Yes. Yeah, I think it'll be good. And my kids are looking forward to it. We've been watching Mary Poppins to get ready for it and for this podcast, too. I've been making them sit down and watch Mary Poppins. We watched again last night.
I think the danger will be, though, if people go in expecting the same thing, because I don't think that's possible. No. I think the Mary Poppins is so odd in a good way, and so sort of baked in the sort of era and a sort of time it was made. Even though in a way it's timeless, it's not at the same time. So there's a lot of things. I don't think it will be the same movie. So who knows? I'm excited. It's very rare that I go into a sequel like this really not having any idea like what it's going to be.
And I mean, Mary Poppins has had a curious kind of rebirth in the last few years, in the sense that I think there's been a stage version. There was that film with Tom Hanks and Emma Thompson, Saving Mr. Banks, just a few years ago, wasn't there? Mm. And then now Mary Poppins returns. So actually, going back to look at the 64 film, it feels like quite an apt time to me. And I mean, I normally start by saying to whoever's on as a guest, like, how would you describe this film to someone who hasn't seen it? But it's quite hard to imagine there are many people... That's it, isn't it? It's hard to imagine there are people who may not have seen it. I mean, there may have been people who avoided it, you know, because there are people who avoid Disney. Trust me, and that might be the case. But Sarah, how would you describe this film to someone who hasn't seen it?
Oh, Jesus. Gosh. Right?
Well, I suppose it's in essence, it's the story of a magical nanny who comes down to a pair of unhappy children and reconstructs the relationship with their parents. I suppose that's the ultimate, that's the core of the whole thing. But everything else around it is mental. How do you even begin to explain all that? So, but and that description doesn't really do it justice either.
Well, we'll dig into it, won't we? But,
it's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. That's all you need to know.
yeah, easy.
Now, I probably hadn't seen this film in... I think it's over 20 years. It might be as many as 25. I don't quite know. And it's been a long, long time. I mean, truthfully, when I was a young kid, I wasn't that interested in films. Football was the only thing I cared about when I was like, you know, between the ages of like 4 and 10, to be honest. So everything else that I like, you know, like films and girls and... Well, that's about it, to be honest. But everything else came later. And, so I think I was probably quite a reluctant viewer of Mary Poppins as a kid. I associate this film with things like wet bank holidays, you know, Christmas and New Year, times when I couldn't get outside with the ball, to be honest. And like I said earlier, it seemed to be a fixture on the TV schedules growing up. Is that how you remember it, Tony? Because I know we're like, you know, not that far apart in age, but it had this cultural presence, didn't
it? Yeah, and obviously, you know, we're both British and, you know, when we were growing up in like the 80s and early 90s, you know, that you didn't have all the internet, TV channels, cable stuff. So you were locked into like 3 or 4 channels. Yeah, it was on, like I say, I always remember it often being on New Year's Day. I loved it as a kid. I remember watching it every year it was on. I'd seen it about about 5 years ago, 5 Christmases ago, I think, actually. I went with a friend and we went to a showing at a cinema. You and I have both been to, Carl, together, the Electric Cinema in Birmingham UK. And they were having a showing. And what was lovely about it was that all the kids were running around and singing that parents and families had brought with them. So it was like an afternoon showing on like a Sunday, I think. And it was a great, it was a lovely atmosphere, you know, to watch that film in. So I saw it then and obviously rewatched it for this podcast. But yeah, it was every year I would watch it, definitely. And I just, there's something about it. I think I always just, it captured that magic for me as a child. Mm. Even, you know, even though by the time we were children, it was getting on for 30 years old, you know, you know, at that age, most of those films you do and you don't always want to see. You know, when I was a kid, I'll be honest, I know you grew up a bit more with older movies, Carl, but I was more interested in watching like the modern action films and sneaking into 15s, you know, and all this kind of thing, and watching the latest, like, I don't know, Sylvester Stallone or whatever. So this was a rare thing for me in going back that far.
Yeah, no, I think there can be an acquired taste, can't they, older movies? But, I mean, Sarah, what about... So we've said, like, it had this presence in, like, British cultural life. Is it the same in America? Is it a fixture in the same kind of way?
I think so. I mean, growing up, I remember watching The Sound of Music probably more often than Mary Poppins. I know they always played The Sound of Music at Easter time, so that's when I associate that movie. It would always be on TV, and then they'd play The Ten Commandments. But yeah, Mary Poppins was always kind of on, and I would always watch it when it was on. And my mom, you know, she was born in the 40s, so whenever these movies were coming out, she was at right about the right age to really be able to go to the theaters and enjoy them and experience them. And so that was something that she wanted to share with me, and she would always get Mary Poppins and The Sound of Music out. She was a big Julie Andrews fan. And so we would always snuggle up in the bed and we would watch them together. And she always loved the musicals and those kinds of movies and Dr. Zhivago and all that kind of stuff. And she would tell me about going to the theater and getting to watch it, you know, back when it was like a big deal to go to the theater. So, yeah, it's very fond of memories for me. And I think most people here, if they don't, you know, they watch Mary Poppins because it's a great kids film and it's something that they can put on and watch with their kids and enjoy again and again.
Yeah. I mean, so I was really, so like I say, it'd been a long time and I was really curious to see what I'd make of it this time. And I really did enjoy it immensely this time, but in a number of ways. Like, the experience of watching it was great. What was also great is just having the songs kind of bouncing around my head for the last few days since. I really enjoyed that. And also, I think thinking about the film has been an interesting one, because actually there's a lot we can discuss here. I wasn't sure if there would be, because it had been so long and I couldn't quite remember it. But there's quite a lot to discuss, I think, isn't there, Tony?
It's a surprisingly layered kind of movie, actually. Yeah. I mean, as I was watching it, I was picking at things that I'd noticed in terms of the deeper thematic ideas and whether or not they're in the source material by P.L. Travers, because obviously it's part of a book series, as the film Saving Mr. Banks, which you mentioned earlier, which charts the relationship between Travers and Disney, shows you. Whether or not a lot of that is in those books, I don't know, because I haven't read them, but the film itself really seems to, and it's like I said earlier, it fits the time it was made in many ways, I think. But it's both considering in culturally where it's going, where we're going, and also it's looking back at the same time. And it's, I was quite pleasantly surprised, because I think beyond the surface of the emotion and the music and the joy of it and the performances and the jokes and the laughter, there is a real undercurrent of theme and ideas, and it enriches it for me. I was watching it the other day with my wife, and I was like, well, this film is really interesting. And I loved it before, but I never really saw it in that way.
I would absolutely agree. And like, would you echo that, Sarah?
Yeah, and I mean, I know that one thing, I haven't read the books either, but I know that they were set in the 1930s and they changed it for the film because they wanted to have kind of more of a vaudeville aspect to the film and be able to incorporate the music and that kind of thing with that sort of theme and with the suffragette movement and that kind of thing. So they chose it to be in 1910 for that reason.
And like, I suppose, Tony, like, the thing of setting it in 1910, like Sarah says, is like a very deliberate choice, and it almost, like that said, the film's released into a time of like great cultural change, and then you know, setting it in 1910 when you had the suffragettes and stuff like that, it kind of not mirrors it exactly, but there's a resonance there in that the narrative then takes place in a time of social change too, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's quite pointed. You know, the 1963-1964 is as counterculture is starting to kick off in the United States. And, you know, this is a very Americanized London. It's a very Americanized England. You know, the set is all... Really? Yeah, you know, it really is. You know, it's one of those things. I think the new movie will be much more... It will look like 30s London. So it's set in, I think, 30s London. It will feel much more British in London in that sense. Whereas this, obviously, it's on a set in Hollywood. And so in many ways, it's sort of tapping into some of the American culture, counterculture going on, and that taking over than more in the British sense. But then I've always felt that setting it in 1910 is deliberate. Setting it in Edwardian times, in the sense of, like you say, the suffragette movement is kicking off. Mrs. Banks, you know, with all her sister suffragette stuff, which is brilliant. As you have that going on, at the same time, you've got the shadow of impending war. You know, the First World War is 4 years away. And you know, I mangled the lyrics Dick Van Dyke sings at the start of this podcast. But, you know, when you look at those lyrics, winds in the east, mist coming in, like something is brewing, about to begin. To me, that's the Great War. You know, that's, you know, the east. It all kicks off in Sarajevo when Franz Ferdinand is murdered. And, you know, can't put my finger on what lies in store, but I feel what's to happen will happen before. War. Perpetual cycle of war. This feeling of brewing change, brewing social change, brewing political change. And that also, you know, is there in the story of Mr. Banks. You know, I mean, the name of the character, Banks, you know, it is this dichotomy between family, between capitalism, between, you know, the power of money and that kind of thing. There's a lot in there, and I think it is reflective of all that. And that's what I hadn't picked up before. You don't see that when you're a child, obviously, you know. But for me, that's what's lying under there.
Yeah, I want to return to a lot of these things as we go on. But before we sort of dive even deeper, I mean, if I had a minor criticism of the film, is I think it's a little bit too long. And maybe it just feels that way because the film's a bit more like episodic than I remembered, you know. Because like you have some sections like, you know, when they take that trip into the chalk painting and all that stuff, where the kids actually become a bit secondary and Mr. Banks is nowhere to be seen. And like, so you've got all these great sequences as spectacle, but they also feel like somewhat of a tangent, but it might just be me. I don't know. It's 2 hours, 20 minutes long, Sarah. Do you feel it runs a bit long or what?
Well, my son would agree with you. You know, we got to right around Feed the Birds. He's like, Mommy, can we watch the rest tomorrow? I'm done. So, yeah, and it is like you said, episodic, and you get through the ups and downs, and, you know, you got a little bit of a slow and a little bit of a fast something, and it is long, but I think worth sticking with. It's one that I do tend to pause every now and then in the middle and go get some snacks and come back to. It's not one that I can sit and watch as a whole, usually, all the way through beginning to end.
I think there's an element though of some of those moments where they're showing off their stars. Mm-hmm. You know, Dick Van Dyke at the time's, you know, famous, quite popular. He's got coming off the Dick Van Dyke Show. Julie Andrews is like a darling for playing My Fair Lady on Broadway, and obviously the Sound of Music is floating around in the ether and things like that. And, you know, even though she wasn't in the My Fair Lady film because Jack Warner kicked her off in favour of Audrey Hepburn, which is, you know, one of those lost great things, having Julie Andrews in the movie with Rex Harrison. But they're both big stars. They're both, well, so I think they're having the scenes like the animated stuff, like, you know, step in time, all these things which you don't really need. Yeah. I was watching it, I was thinking, this takes so many like random turns. And like these days they'd never get that.
Up on the rooftops.
Yeah, exactly. Up on the rooftops, step in time. It never happened. Like they'd never let you do it. Be like, get rid of that. No. Don't need it. But then that's why it's beautiful, because you go off and do all this stuff and you sit there thinking, what is this about? Why are they in like a painting? Just having tea with a little like, you know, creature. It's great though. I love it for that.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Dick Van Dyke there, and before we come to Julie Andrews, let's just chat about him quickly, because I think he's really charming here.
Oh, you're right there, Governor.
Well, that's it. He's got this legendarily bad accent, and Over the years, when I've heard Mary Poppins discussed, his accent's always referenced. But like I say, it's been so long since I've seen the film that I couldn't quite remember. And it's even worse than I remembered. I mean, do you know, he's like inventing all sorts of different vowels. It's quite hard at times to work out exactly what accent he's going for, I think. But
he said he had a coach, a voice coach, who was English with an Irish extraction. And I think his words were, when they said, well, you had a voice coach, he said, yeah, but he didn't do it any better than I did. So it's like the blind leading the blind.
But he is really charming, isn't he, Sarah? You know, so yeah. It's really hard to like hold it against him. You know?
Yeah. I mean, it's Dick Van Dyke. You can't go wrong with him.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, and yeah. I mean...
playing a dual role, of course. Playing two roles.
Right?
Especially yes. Mr. Dawes. Rose Banks.
It was fun to listen to the commentary with him and Julie Andrews. And, you know, they talked about his character. And from what I could gather, I don't think many people on set knew that he was Mr. Dawes. He got, even on set as they were filming it, and then they got to the very end and everybody was so surprised that it was him. But he actually begged Walt Disney for that role. He had to give up some, he said he would do it for free. He's like, no extra charge. It's funny on the commentary to listen to him talk about it. He's like, no extra charge, I'll do it. And apparently they worked out a deal for him to donate $4,000 to CalArts, because that was what Disney was just starting up, his school that he was just starting up. So yeah, that's how that worked out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it was brilliant. And I saw something online recently about you know, how Dick Van Dyke hasn't aged at all. He still looks the same, but it's like Mr. Dawes and then now, and he really does look exactly the same.
But what isn't it that in Mary Poppins Returns he's playing
the son
who's now the age of the old man, yeah, which is now Dick Van Dyke's basically his age.
Yes, yes.
I think that's brilliant. That's a genius thing. It's, I'm sure, so I read great as well that they wanted Julie Andrews to play like the bird lady or something like that as well, and it just didn't happen for whatever reason. To have both of them in there, that would have been lovely. But like, yeah, I think that's just a bit of genius. He's so good as old Dawes, though. My wife never knew, you know. She never knew that was him. So when we were watching it, I said, that's Dick Van Dyke. She went, no, it's not. I said, yes, it is. Listen, and then once you hear it, you're like, yeah, you can tell
makes
then.
Sense. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, because even on the closing credits, I think his name's kind of rearranged. It rearranges itself.
It's very good, yeah.
Another quick interesting thing he said on the commentary was that there was a group of elderly people who kept writing to him and saying how offended they were that he was portraying elderly people in such a manner. And they're like, we're not like that and this and that. And he's like, well, I'm not, you know, trying to portray elderly people. I want to be this person when I get old. Like, this is who I hope to be one day. And he actually made it. So I think that's pretty glorious that he actually got to live such a long life. And he just wanted to be a feisty old man one day, and now he is, and it's great. Yeah. And he's a treasure. But yeah.
He is. I wonder if any London chimney sweeps wrote to him. I mean, like we've kind of said, I think that there are so many fascinating aspects of this film. And I think one of the main things is Mary Poppins herself, you know. And I think there are like a few different ways we can talk about her, but maybe first of all, in terms of Julie Andrews, you know, so her first film role, excellent performance. You can't imagine anyone else. Well, we have to imagine someone else now because Emily Blunt's going to do it, of course. But you know what I mean? An iconic role. One of the things I think's really great is her singing, to be honest. Because I was looking at something Peter Kemp had written about the film, and he says, Andrews chose to sing for meaning over colour and tone. And I know what he means, because like, she's not a singer. She doesn't kind of overwhelm the material, you know, but she sings in a very clear way. And I think these are songs that have a lot of meaning, you know, they derive a lot of meaning from their lyrics. And it seems to me like she never loses sight of that.
Yeah, it's a very human performance, which is ironic, because she's, in a way, she's a distant figure. You know, she comes into the story for a specific purpose. And then there's the whole thing at the end with her little umbrella that goes, I know how you feel about these children, Mary Poppins, and all that kind of thing, right? Again, sorry about the impression. But you know, it's, and then she's sort of, oh, shut up, and all this kind of thing. So she's got to be fairly, she's got to play it fairly cool and calculated, but at the same time, with that warmth, and that does come across in the lyrics, yeah. And she doesn't showboat, you know, that's the other thing. She doesn't,
yeah, exactly.
She doesn't make it her film about her, you know, and a lesser actress would have done that, would have tried nudging away in. It's very much, you know, what you get, all the people, you know, you a lot of these songs, a lot of these famous performances and these famous, you know, songs in the movie, they're not necessarily by Julie Andrews. You know, you've got things like Sister Suffragette with Glynis Johns, you've got Step in Time and Chim Chimney and all that with Dick Van Dyke, and A Man Has Dreams with David Tomlinson, which is probably my favourite actually. And so they all get their moment of singing in different various ways. So she's great in that sense. She keeps it anchored. She keeps it her story. Well, it's not her story. It's the story of the children, really. But, and Mr. Banks. But she keeps it very grounded while never overshadowing everything. I think you basically just said that, Carl. And I think that's surprising. You don't always realise that until you're watching. You're like, yeah, you know what? She's the heart of the film, but she doesn't take over.
Yeah. Well, I thought that from the get-go, in the sense that you see her in the first minute, like, sat on that cloud, don't you? But then it's probably another 15 or 20 minutes until she, like, appears back in the storyline, isn't it? I think, Sarah.
Yeah. And it's, I know I keep bringing up the commentary, but there's a lot of really interesting stuff on there. When she drifts down and arrives and then hops over the fence, that's actually not Julie Andrews, it was her devil. And so her actual first appearance in motion pictures is when she knocks on the door, and the first line I think that she ever spoke on film was right when they arrive inside the painting. And it's such a simple line. She said that it was really, you know, the perfect first line to do because it was so simple. And it's interesting to listen to her talk about the experience, because she was talking about how nervous she was the whole time, and how she, you know, was kind of unsure of herself, and that she just, you know, had such a fun time doing it though. And it was really how Disney made them feel so welcome, and how they really took care of them. And she said that it was really a film that helped her feel comfortable and grow into her, you know, becoming a film actress, because she was so used to Broadway. But, you know, she said that they actually had Walt Disney said that they chose the painting sequence and Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious and that whole thing because it was the closest sequence that they had to a Broadway show in the whole film. And it's, you know, the production and the dancing and the singing and all of that. So he wanted them to feel comfortable in their element to kind of get into the film and all that. So I think her performance is perfectly Mary Poppins, because she doesn't, like you said, she doesn't overwhelm, and she sort of directs everyone. But that's Mary Poppins' job in the actual film, is to come in and not, she doesn't take over, but she does. But at the same time, she's so unassuming about it. And she, you know, I love this sequence where she's talking to Mr. Banks and he's telling her all these things about the kids. And then she essentially tells him that he's taking the kids to the bank the next day. But he's like, was that my idea? That was my idea, right? And he's like, like, no, I don't know. But yeah. So I just love that about her. And that's exactly how she just nailed it, really.
No, she really did. I totally agree. And so, yeah, as a star vehicle for Julie Andrews, then, you know, phenomenal, I think.
And her first film. Exactly. An Academy Award. Can you imagine winning an Academy Award your first time out? Like, how do you come back from that? I don't know. Of course, it's Julie Andrews, so she really is practically perfect in every way.
She is. She's a national treasure, of course. And, I mean, there's that level to it, but there's also, like, you know, she's quite interesting as like a supernatural entity, I think, you know, because, I mean, Tony, you were saying to me off air before, you know, you sort of think of her as kind of an angel figure, but she kind of is, isn't she? She's kind of like some weird sort of cross between like a fairy and a witch or something, isn't she? Mm.
It's strange because obviously what one of the things I think that's great about the film is that it never tries to explain any of that, you know, because it's such a fable, because it's a story about children wishing for somebody who can come down and who can come into their life and repair what they don't have and, you know, give them back their parents, essentially, give them back that love in their life. She's conjured almost. It's like she's, but then at the same time, she's not, because Bert knows her of old. There's the sense that she does this a lot, that she goes into people's lives and she fixes things, or, crucially, she helps them understand how to fix it themselves, which is exactly why I think that Mary Poppins is kind of a... I always see it as a kind of a cross between an Inspector Calls, which is the classic story, you know, going back years, about an inspector who comes to a house because at a dinner party because one of the guests killed a woman in the past, and then there is a sense that that person is, and then at the end you find out there is no detective. I can't remember his name now, but there is no detective, and basically he's somebody who come in to make these people realise what their lives are about and who did this and things like that. And A Christmas Carol, which is obviously the story of Mr. Banks in a way. It's the story of the person coming to realise that, you know, wealth and money and that kind of thing isn't as important as people and the humanity and that kind of thing. So to me, it feels like, if you take the murder out of things, it feels like a fusion of both. And Mary Poppins is that ethereal figure. You know, in the Christmas Carol story, you've got the ghost servant, you've got the ghosts of Christmas past, future, present. And in Inspector Calls, you've got this angelic, strange... Again, you never know who that person is. You never know who he is, where he's come from, but he's come for a purpose. He's come to ask them questions that make them reflect on themselves. And that's exactly what Mary Poppins does. She comes in, she sorts the house out, but then she starts to do things. And at the end, when, you know, the umbrella says, well, you know, aren't you sad? Like, they love their father and everything. And she says, well, that's how it should be. And that's the whole point. So... She's sort of non-denominational, though. She's like, I think I said to you, she's like an angel, but then it's not that simple. That she's more of an idea, in that sense, and more of a not a plot device, because she is a character in her own right. But at the same time, she's essentially embodiment of a magical figure, a magical wish fulfillment figure.
Yeah, well, let me tell you how somebody called Cristina Perez Valverde describes her. She says that Mary Poppins is an example of the trope of the powerful spinster, right?
Okay.
Which is a female endowed with magic powers and inhabiting realms beyond the ordinary world. And these can be good figures, you know, like fairy godmothers, or they can be bad figures like witches. And the women that kind of fit this description, they sort of question the very order from which they're excluded, with their extraordinary skills, capable of defying normal human rules. Her power manifests as an unmanageable force that escapes patriarchal control. And I think that definitely applies to Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because none of us have read the books, but apparently in the books there's some quite key differences between the figure of Mary, which is apparently in the books she's a much grumpier figure. But also, what's really fascinating is apparently in the books there's more of an emphasis on magic and, like, rituals and, like, even references to the occult and stuff like that. So, yeah, I don't know, Sarah. I know you're interested in magic and stuff like that, aren't you? So,
yeah.
What do you think?
Well, one of my favourite lines in the film is when she is coming in with her umbrella and they go, is she a witch? And they're like, well, she's not a witch. She doesn't have a broom. So, I mean, I think that was kind of an important line, though, to include in the film, because it could be easy to say that she's just a witch and this is all magic, but, you know, like Tony said, she comes in and importantly teaches the family how to fix themselves and makes herself unnecessary in the end, and that's as it should be. So, you know, while she does have her magic and everything... I guess she is more of like a fairy godmother, so there definitely is magic involved, but I guess she could also kind of be compared to, you know, Jiminy Cricket and Pinocchio.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
She's more of a conscience than a witch or anything, I don't, you know. But if she is kind of a witch, she's a good witch because you know she's there to help people, and I feel like she only uses her magic, you know, to kind of get a point across or to teach a lesson. It's not, you know, or to show that she's different. Like, you know, when she gets the kids to take their medicine and it's different colors and different tastes and helping them clean up and making everything a game. And, you know, she makes life, she teaches the family that they can have fun and still have order and that kind of thing. So
there's a reluctance to it as well, isn't there, in a way, as well? I mean, the whole stuff with the painting, she's the one going, no, we haven't got time for this.
Yeah.
You know, don't be so silly and all this. And Bert's like, oh, come on, it'll be all right, off, and all this kind of thing. So, yeah, it is interesting how she uses all that.
Yeah, well, she's here in a way to sort of challenge the father figure, it seems, isn't it? You know, so if we talk, I mentioned that quote about the patriarchal order. So Mr. Banks kind of embodies that, I guess. And this is kind of baked into the film from very early on, because Mrs. Banks, as one of you mentioned, sings that song about sister suffragette, about women's rights. But she's also, you know, when Mr. Banks actually does turn up, Mrs. Banks is immediately quite, like, deferential to him and stuff. So I didn't know if it was meant ironically, because you sort of needed Mary Poppins to be the one who could come in and challenge the father figure. So maybe that kind of factored into the way Mrs. Banks was kind of characterised, if that makes sense.
I think it does. I think in a way, Mrs. Banks is, she's detached from reality in that she doesn't really, she's so wrapped up in the cause, you know, in this champion of women's rights, which is a great, you know, a great cause, a noble cause, a liberal cause. And, you know, it is that whole opposites attract thing, I suppose, with her. And, you know, you wonder if there was a point when they were younger that Mr. Banks was a lot less buttoned down and stiff upper lip and that kind of thing. And he was a bit more of a liberal himself, which is maybe what attracted her to him in the first place. And then as time went on and as he had a family and he was drawn more into the bank, that he maybe became more of that, you know, authoritarian figure in that sense. But she's a bit divorced from reality, whereas Mary Poppins is all about what's going on in that house. And she's the one who challenges him. So even though Mrs. Banks is challenging the patriarchy, she's doing it as part of this noble sisterhood, and she's running around and she's happy and she's wearing the sash and all this kind of thing. But in her own home, she can't do that. She can't do that. And it is Mary Poppins who comes in and does that. I think that's true.
Yeah, because Mr. Banks, I think it's really funny the way it's set up, isn't it, Sarah, where he sings that song and it's got these exaggerated, like, imperial overtones where he's talking about the heirs to my dominion and I'm the lord of my castle and all this. So it's set up in quite an amusing way, I think, with him as a bit of an authoritarian, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like that, you know, Mrs. Banks kind of, she is for the cause, and then she says something along the lines of, you know how Mr. Banks feels about the cause. And it's like, oh dear. So I think in part she is very, you know, airy and flighty and that kind of thing. But I think she also knows how her husband is. She knows him very well. And so, you know, a little bit of that, I think, is her catering to him and to just, you know, because he is very orderly and authoritative, and she's like, okay, well, honey, you know, you do what you need to do, and I'll just be over here, you know, managing, you know, everything with when the Admiral Boom sets off the cannon, and it's always the women who go to save everything, and they've got this little, you know,
posts, everyone. Posts.
But Mr. Banks just goes about his life because, you know, he can't be bothered with any of that stuff. So I think that definitely speaks to her character, and Mary Poppins is kind of the in-between of all that.
Yeah. I think there's a really interesting debate we can try and get into here, which is, like, how feminist is this film, right? Because, like, Peter Kemp, who I mentioned earlier, here's what he said, which is, like, what distinguishes Mary Poppins as a feminist or proto-feminist film musical is the selflessness of the heroine's one-woman crusade, the magnanimous meaning of a mission. So what do you think about that? I think that's, you know, that's a very positive way of putting it, isn't it?
It's difficult because I think it can be read as a in a feminist way, but I think I don't think it tries to really beat you over the head with that. I don't think that's really what it is essentially. I think it's more about You know, we were discussing this earlier, and you know, I was making the point that it's quite anti-establishment. You know, it's very much, you know, and that, again, it goes back to like the early 60s. It's being written and made in that it was a time when people were, you know, as we headed towards a lot of the American crises in the 60s. You know, you've just had the assassination of Kennedy, or you will have that around the time, probably when they were filming this. Actually, it was probably not near that time. You know, you've had the Cuban Missile Crisis, you've got Vietnam on the horizon, all these different things that are challenging, you know, how people look at their rulers, their leaders in America. So you've got this, establishment that the film is thumbing its nose to in a way. And Mary Poppins is that classic, is an example of a strong feminine figure who comes into an authoritarian household and interviews the boss, not the other way around. You know, she comes in and she's the one telling him what to do. And so I think it's more along those lines, really. And it's challenging that while still, and this is, I think, the point you made, Carl, reinforcing certain family traditions, you know, in that unit, you know, because the American culture may have been anti-establishment, but it's always held to the traditions of family. It's never lost that. It's always wanted to get back to that. And I think that's what the film does. So I don't know. Sarah, you might see it differently as a woman, but I don't know if it's particularly feminist.
Yeah, I don't know that... I mean, there's definitely elements there. I mean, Mary Poppins is a woman of her own means and in a time when that was rare. But, I mean, she's magical, so it's kind of hard to establish that with her. I mean, I think the things that stood out to me most were obviously, you know, the suffragettes, and I mean, before Election Day not too long ago, that's all I was singing all day, every day. but yeah, and so I don't know that it's necessary. I think I would agree more with Tony about the themes and everything, but I definitely think there's elements there. And especially one thing that stood out to me this time around when I was watching it that I had never noticed before is, you know, when they're singing the Jolly Holiday and she's talking about Bert being such a gentleman and how a woman feels safe when she's near him and he would never overstep his boundaries and that kind of thing. And it's like, wow, you're really making this very clear that you guys have this platonic relationship, and it's not.
Well, it's funny because Dick Van Dyke's expression there, I couldn't quite read it. It was like either he didn't understand what she was saying, or he's a bit like, you know, not that chuffed with it. I don't know.
Your sweet gentility is crystal clear.
The other thing though with that is that there's a lot about class in this. There's a lot about class in this film, in that you've got the scene where Jane and Michael, they run away. And they go into, you know, the dockside or whatever, and that leads to the chimney sweep bit and everything like that. But then, you know, you've got this toothless old woman goes, "How dare you come with me?" And you've got the dog, you know, that's barking at them. And so it's like they're leaving this safe, you know, middle to upper class world, and then running into this dark, you know, underbelly of London. But it's not, and that's the whole point. In that the film is very keen to point out that then they bump into Bert, who's the nicest guy in the world. And all these chimney sweeps are there dancing, having a good time, and it feels like they've got their own world. That's the other thing I love about this film, and it's really clear in that sequence. The even though I said about it being a very Americanized London, they paint it in a beautifully sort of classically Victorian way almost. I know it's Edwardian times, but it's there's some beautiful matte paintings of London in what they do, and it makes London itself magical when they get to the underbelly of it. You know, that whole rooftop scene, there's that brilliant shot where all the chimney sweeps are dancing on the chimneys in like silhouette set against the sky. And it's amazing. It's an amazing shot. And there's some really great moments that sort of underscore how the fear that the aristocracy and the upper classes and everything might have of the chimney sweeps is unfounded. These people are no threat. They're no danger. And Bert is an encapsulation of that, really. And then Mary Poppins can flip between the two. Mary Poppins has no, she's not grounded in anything. She is everywhere. She can be with anyone. Mm-hmm. And I love that about the film.
Yeah, and like it's quite funny that, like you mentioned, this magical portrayal of London, and I suppose what it does then, it's all this soot and like the filth or whatever is actually portrayed as quite appealing, you know.
Yeah.
To go back to the feminist thing, so just quickly, and then bring it back onto class, I think, is So, like, the counter-argument is that what Mary Poppins ultimately does doesn't change the world that radically, you know. So Mr. Banks is reinstalled as a patriarch. He's changed a bit, but, you know, like we say, traditional values have kind of been maintained. The capitalist system's kind of shown as being a bit dysfunctional through the film, but that's still going strong by the end of it too. My point would be kind of similar to what Sarah said, in that you said, like, oh, well, I always remember the suffragettes and stuff like that, is, like, sometimes you do get these climb downs in Hollywood films where the ending kind of reverses some of what came before. But really what kind of sticks with you, I think, is some of the boldness of earlier on. It's really complex, though, in terms of class, because, like, one of the things I love about that final scene is that you've got, like, people of different class backgrounds, like, mingling happily together, you know, so the Bankses and Bert and the people from the bank and stuff like that. So at a time when class divisions were much more rigid than they are today, both in respect to, like, 1910 when it's set and the 1960s even still when it was released, even though it's a time of some upheaval or whatever, but it's different now, isn't it, Tony? Because now we all happily mix with our chimney sweeps, don't we?
Yes, there's no class problem in England at all right now. But it does have a very positive outlook on that. And I think, again, that's representative of how the 1960s, even though it did have its problems with all of these things and class and race and all this kind of stuff, it was a very, you know, forward-thinking decade. You only have to look at a lot of the movies and the TV shows, you know, I mean, think things that were coming down the pipe, like Star Trek, you know, 2 years later, which is, you know, a very progressive, forward-thinking TV show all about races coming together. So it's the 60s does a lot of that outward, forward-looking stuff, and it uses a lot of magic, a lot of parable, a lot of science fiction, a lot of fantasy in order to tell those kind of stories. And Mary Poppins is no different in that sense. And that last scene is a good encapsulation of it. Although I when I watched it the other day, I kind of wish that Mr. Banks had said no when Dawes says, "Oh, we'll give you the job back." I wanted him to go, "I don't need it. It's fine. I'm good."
Yeah.
Because like you say, it reinforces the fact that he needs the bank. And the whole purpose of that scene with, you know, old Dawes when he's laughing is he doesn't need them. You know, he's happy with that. He's happy skipping off supercalifragilistic and all that kind of. He doesn't need it anymore. And he's realised that the family and the children are more important. So that is a climb down. So it sort of gives with one hand, it takes with another.
It's hard to hold it against the film too much, I think. And I definitely agree with everything you're saying about the 60s, because there's all sorts going on, like, in the real world at this time in America as well, you know. So things like the contraceptive pills becoming available. I think the Equal Pay Act came in 63 in America, and there were things like the Civil Rights Movement, of course. So, yeah, it's an interesting contrast, isn't it, between, like, the film setting and the real-world context, I suppose. But, like we said, Sarah, it's hard to hold some of these traditional notions against the film. And, you know, even maybe you don't have to hold them against it. There's nothing wrong with a traditional idea of family as such, I don't think. Is there? It's just there are, like, alternatives to it.
No, yeah. I mean, especially, like, having parents be aware of their kids and love their kids and to be a family unit, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And it's a smaller moment than, you know, Mr. Banks's, but at the end, you know, when Mrs. Banks gives her suffragette sash to be the tail of the kite, it's kind of representative of her saying, well, yes, the suffragettes are definitely important, but my kids need their kite, and here it is. So, you know, she has her own moment. It's a little bit smaller, but I think it's still important.
Can I tell you guys a little personal story with this?
Yeah.
So, like I said, I love Mary Poppins growing up. But then over the last 15 years or so, it's made me very sad for several reasons. The principal, the main reason being that I didn't have a relationship with my father for 16 years, up until this year, actually. And for a long time, if ever I did watch Mary Poppins in that interim, the scene, the whole transformation of Banks, and it's why Mr. Banks is my favourite character, in that the transformation of Mr. Banks would always have me crying at the end, because it reminded me of our happy family. And in terms of my parents and things like that, that's not something I've had since I was a teenager, sadly. And the other night when I watched it, I started crying again with my wife. And you know, she was lovely about it and everything like that. And I reunited with my dad this year, because I got married this year. And thankfully, I've reunited with him, which is lovely. And it was a long time coming. So I was, I was crying, but it still made me cry. The whole thing at the end with the kite is, I think it will always affect me in a way, because it reminds me of family, of the unity of family. So I like that message in it. You know, I really do. It's a lovely, hopeful message about, yes, okay, you may be a capitalist, you may be in this system, you know, but ultimately you can do both. You can love your children, you can have that happy family, and yeah, you can still be involved in this system. So on the one hand, while I wish he'd turn around and said to Dawes, I don't need the job, on the other hand, I don't mind. And so that's my personal little story with Mary Poppins. It still makes me cry.
Well, it makes me cry too.
Yeah. Yeah, listening to your story has brought a tear to my eye, Tony. No. But,
sorry.
You know what, I fully understand it, because this is actually a very powerful film, I think. And I also think that, like, Let's Go Fly a Kite sequence is, like, transcendent, you know. Mm-hmm. But also that sequence about with Feed the Birds, I think, like, luminous as well.
Oh, yeah.
So that was one of the big surprises for me, because I'd completely forgotten about Feed the Birds. I mean, I could remember lots of the songs from when I saw this as a child, but Feed the Birds had just kind of escaped my memory. I mean, I probably wouldn't have been that interested, because it's not upbeat, you know, as a small kid. That's probably why I've forgotten it.
But it's also another example of the disparity in terms of class and in terms of money. You know, that woman is sitting in the shadow of these gigantic, you know, obelisk banks. You know, she's feeding these birds and she's got nothing, and she's in the shadow. That's the other thing with this film. There's all these looming, almost Romanesque sort of, you know, pains to authority and money and capitalism and banking and government and all these kind of things. Always looming over London, it seems, in this film. And that sequence with Feed the Birds is a really good example of that real disparity that by the end of the film is one that they start to challenge in that sense. But it's a heartbreaking song and a heartbreaking moment, definitely.
Yeah. Like, guys, there's a reason why this is an appropriate film for us to discuss for the Christmas episode of the podcast. And it's not just the sequel, though there is that. It's not just the fact this is, like, you know, a perennial fixture on the TV schedules, although there's that too. But I kind of hinted this to you guys in our chat earlier on Twitter, but there's a way to read the character of Mary Poppins as kind of a Christ figure.
Yeah, I'm really interested in this.
I was going to say, can you see where I might be going with this? Is there anything that kind of jumps out at you when I say that? Or are you just waiting for me to...
She doesn't have a beard, Carl. It's invalid.
Touche. What about you, Sarah? Can you see where I'm going with this or not?
No, not really. I'm just going to be honest. So, yeah.
Well, yeah, so this is not actually my theory. I need to give credit where it's due. So I read an academic journal article by a guy called Niles Reddick about this. Here's part of his argument anyway. So Mary Poppins has a divine method of arrival and departure. She assumes a role as a commoner within society in the form of a nanny. She exhibits superhuman abilities. So, I mean, so far, that's pretty general. You know, you can say this about a lot of fictional characters like Superman, for example. But it goes into more detail, right? So, she sacrifices herself to others. She dresses simplistically. She conducts miracles of sorts. She exhibits poverty in the sense that there's a lack of worldly goods in her bag. And this is the one I really like, Tony, because you mentioned that verse about the east wind and, like, the resonance with the encroachment of the First World War and stuff like that. But he says that this actually, her arriving on the east wind relates to the assumed direction of Christ's return, because traditionally people were buried facing east so they could rise from the grave to view Jesus' return. I never knew this until I read his article. And he mentions the bird lady, which I thought was fascinating. So he says all these supporting characters help reinforce this Christ-esque figure that Mary Poppins is, which is like Mr. Banks fulfills the kind of Judas role, because you remember there's that point where he wants to sack her.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a betrayal of sorts. So he's kind of a Judas figure. Bert's her kind of disciple. And like you mentioned, that they seem to have this pre-existing relationship. And the character of the bird woman exists, in his view, to help Mary Poppins convey a Christian message of charity. And whether you guys think that Jesus... He's not saying she is literally Jesus. He's saying, yeah, you know, a Christ-like figure. But I really like that take on it. And there is, like we say, through that whole Feed the Birds sequence, there is a very spiritual feel. Like, if you think about when it comes back to Mary Poppins when it dissolves back to her, and she's got this kind of enraptured expression on her face, and she's like gazing up to the heavens, it looks like. Yeah, just a very special feel to that sequence, I feel. And
well, can I tell you about my own Feed the Birds experience? Because it was not rapturous at all. When I went to St. Paul's, I was so excited the whole time. And, you know, I was like, I'm going to be Mary Poppins here and feed the birds and sing. And they've got the signs, don't feed the birds, everywhere. And I was like, well, you know, I have to reenact Mary Poppins. It's iconic. Like, I've got to do this. You know, when am I going to be back in London and at St. Paul's and be able to feed the birds? So I started feeding the birds. Oh, it was bad. There's a reason those signs are there, guys. There were so many birds.
Did he become like the birds Hitchcock?
Oh, yes. It was that. It was exactly that. There were so many pigeons. And, you know, my husband was with me and we were just like, we have to get out of here now. It was terrifying. I'm not generally afraid of birds, but I was, yeah, it was not a good idea. Do not feed the birds.
No,
it was bad.
I like that theory though. I think it's interesting. Yeah, I don't really necessarily think it's reaching too far. I think it's an interesting way of looking at it if you look at it from a religious parable aspect. Yeah, why not?
Yeah, well, I think what I was trying to drive at here through the way I've kind of tried to structure this discussion really is like through the character of Mary Poppins, there are all these ways of kind of interpreting the film. So we talked about, you know, the film is a star vehicle for Julie Andrews. Mary Poppins is this kind of magical figure, and the level then of like possibly a religious parable as well. So it's what we all said at the outset, I think, but I was actually very surprised how much was going on here, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. It's if you look at it from more than just the songs and the, you know, the colour of it and the family friendly niceness of it, I think, yeah, you'll be surprised at what you can pick out.
Is there anything else you wanted to chip in, Sarah, before we see what the listeners thought?
Oh, no, I think that pretty much covers it, yeah.
All right, so as I always do, I put out a call on Twitter to our listeners to see what they think about this film, and very, very positive responses too. So Gabriella said, absolutely adore it. I think it's one of the best films Disney ever made. Julie Andrews is perfect as Mary Poppins, and she definitely deserved her Oscar. I love that she won because she showed Jack Warner her worth, which he dismissed by not casting her in My Fair Lady, which we referred to earlier, I think. I think Tony brought it up. Erica D said, Mary Poppins is a good film filled with lovely moments where I find that it runs a bit long. Julie was beautiful and divinely cast. Dick jokes about the accent he used, but I thought he was great. The children's parents were memorable. Glynis Johns, who is still with us, had a cute, upbeat voice and provided some genuine warmth in the home. David Tomlinson was too old to have such young kids, but he was so lovable. I don't know if he is too old to have young kids, because, like,
yeah,
I mean, my granddad, I think this is, I think I'm right in saying my granddad was 67 years old when he fathered his last child. So,
wow.
I don't know how old Tomlinson was, but he wasn't that old.
I think Tomlinson was about, I think he was about 50. I think he was about 50 when he filmed this. Yeah, so he's not. Mm. No, he can. He's still got some lead in his pencil, so to speak.
So let's see. Luke Winch said, "One of my all-time favorite childhood films. Oddly, I have appreciated it more the older I get." Yeah, I definitely get that, Luke, to be honest. I also like to think that Mary came to save Mr. Banks as much as the kids, if not more. Yep, mm-hmm. His redemption is one of the most important arcs in the film for me. Robert Abidez said, virtual perfection. In my humble opinion, it is second only to The Wizard of Oz as a family movie. It has catchy songs, Spoonful of Sugar, Funny, How Are You at Catching Mice, and Heartwarming, Let's Go Fly a Kite. I dread the remake. I understand why people would say they're a bit wary of the sequel, you know, that it's hard when a film has such a classic status, isn't it? But I'm always of the opinion, like, wait and see. But I do get why people would take that view, if that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
I was really apprehensive about it until I heard about, you know, Emily Blunt, and I think she'll be all right. Yeah.
Kathy G said, wonderful movie, one I was very happy to share with my kids who loved it as much as I did. Blue Stocking Circle said, all three of us rated it positively, with two of us surprised we liked it even more as adults than we did as children. We recommend it for the excellent songs and, of course, Julie Andrews, if nothing else, though one of us thinks it is a genuine masterpiece, beginning to end. I mean, masterpiece is a big word. Is it? Is Mary Poppins a masterpiece?
Yep.
Yep.
End of discussion.
There we go.
No, no. Do you know what? Right. I think so. In a certain realm of cinema, yes. I don't think Disney ever gets more magical than this, and that's saying something with the amount that Disney have done. And I think if you want a pure piece of, try and think of a musical that has more songs in it that you know, or you will be singing afterwards. There aren't many. This has so many. Some of them, you know, you'll be one or two you walk away with, and you'll be humming and you'll be singing. You could sing all of this and all forever. And I don't think there's ever quite been a film like Mary Poppins, and I don't think there ever will be again.
Yeah.
I'm inclined to agree with you guys, to be fair. I didn't necessarily expect to think it was a masterpiece coming back to it after all these years, but for all the reasons we've discussed, I thought that it is a magical film. There's a lot going on. It's one of the great Disney films. So, yeah, I don't think it's putting that too strongly. Maybe that's the Christmas kind of sentimentality creeping out of me. I don't know. But before we go, guys, I mean, do you want to just point people to where you are online and what are the things you're up to and stuff like that? Sarah, how about you?
Yep. I'm Sarah L. Blair, SarahLBlair, on Twitter, and I'm on Instagram too, author Sarah Blair, and yeah, I just hang out mostly in the X-Files basement group on Facebook, but I'm always up for talking about movies, and especially the X-Files, and all that kind of stuff. You know, I'm regular on the X-Cast, so yeah, it's good times.
Mary Poppins herself could be the subject of an X-File, I think.
Can you imagine Mulder and Scully investigating Mary Poppins?
Well, I wouldn't be interested in the X-Files at all, I'm afraid, so, you know, it's no point talking to me about that. I run the X-Cast, which is the X-Files podcast we all met on. You can find that at @X_cast on Twitter, and it's on Facebook, as Sarah mentioned, as a group. Join us if you like that show. If you don't like that show, don't talk to us. Simple as that. No, I'm joking. and yeah, you can find me at AJ Black Writer. Otherwise, I am variously doing all kinds of different, whether it's podcasts, writing. I'm finishing a book soon, so I'm knee-deep in that right now. So there's various different things. So that's where you can find me.
Great stuff. Cheers, both. And I just, before we go, I wanted to just kind of reflect a little bit, because this, like I said at the outset, this is the end of season one of the podcast, as it were. This is actually going to be the last episode for just a little while. We're going to take January off, just while I get some episodes recorded and in the bank. We'll be back in February, taking a look at a few like Oscar Best Picture winners. But yeah, I just wanted to say, really, it's been a great journey for me this last few months, you know, starting my own podcast, and I've really loved it. You know, I've made some new friendships. I'd like to think, you know, strengthen some existing ones with people like Tony and now Sarah on the podcast as well, you know. So I just wanted to run down quickly and give a thank you to everyone who's contributed so far. So Tony and Sarah, first of all, thank you both.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Can I just say, I think you've done a fantastic job so far. I think this is a really great podcast. Taps a niche, I think, so many podcasts aren't doing. It's really insightful, really interesting. It's an education while being fun. So, you know, you're doing a great job, mate. Well done.
I second that opinion. Absolutely.
Thank you both. And yeah, I just wanted to thank everyone else. So some people here that, like Tony and Sarah, will know. And what's been great is meeting some new people through this too. So let me say thanks to all my guests so far. So Clara Cook, Nathan Drake, Kalechi Ihanulo, Jessica Pickens, Darren Mooney, Paige Schechter, Raquel Stetcher, Kathy Glinsky, Earl J. Hess and Pratibha A. Debulka were kind of inadvertent participants, weren't they, Tony? Because you recorded something with them and then I was able to release it, which was a happy kind of convergence of events, wasn't it?
Ages ago as well, so they must have thought it was never going to come out. So I appreciate their patience if they ever listen to this.
that was a great little interview you did with them. Let me also thank Russell Hugo, Brandon Shane Mutala, Rosie Powell, Karen Burrows-Hansbury, Andrew Quinn, Bex and Eason from the Time for Cakes and Ale podcast, and Vanessa Bettino. So I couldn't have got this far without each and every one of you, so thank you. Also want to quickly thank Tom Whelan, who did a bit of editing for me on a very early recording that Sarah and I did that isn't actually going to see the light of day, I don't think. while I was just trying to get the podcast off the ground.
Well, you've already got a secret podcast that you're never going to release. That's cool. I don't have that. I've done 300 episodes of the X-Cast. I don't have one of those. That's ace.
It's a lost episode, yeah. I think. You know, like some of these Disney cartoons that never get re-released. And finally, a word of thanks to Rebecca Jane Park, who's helped me a bit with some behind-the-scenes things relating to the podcast too. So I think the final thank you has to go to everyone who's listened. I mean, I had no idea when I started this podcast whether there'd be any real interest in it, you know. So it's always very humbling, you know, when people get in touch to say they've listened to the show and enjoyed it, or they've watched a film that we're covering and stuff like that. So thanks to everyone who's done that. Or just thanks to anyone who's listened in general, really. Right, so you can find The Movie Palace in all the usual places on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Your Christmas present to me, listeners, I think, could be leaving me an iTunes review, I think. If you took 60 seconds to rate and review the podcast on iTunes, that would be very much appreciated. What we're going to do, we're going to have a closing sing song, aren't we? But I'm going to give people an out, because I'm going to say that I'm going to put the end credits music first. Because, I mean, Tony and I, we actually had people enjoy our singing on the Night of the Hunter podcast.
Yeah, what was that about? Are they okay?
I don't know. Well, I wasn't on there, so it may just, you know, just tell everybody to stop listening, just to, you know, take your earphones out, turn your volume down a bit.
Escape now, for God's sake, people. What are you doing?
Yeah, if you're listening to this podcast and you've got perfect pitch, you're not going to want to listen to our sing song, I don't think. So this is your time to turn off the podcast, but sing song after the end credits. Merry Christmas to both of you. Merry Christmas to everyone listening. I hope you can join us next year when the curtain rises once more at the Movie Palace.
However, did you manage it?
With tuppence for paper and strings, you can have your own set of wings. With your feet on the ground, you're a bird in flight. With your fist holding tight to the string of your kite.
Let's go fly a kite up to the highest height.
Let's go fly a kite and send it soaring up through the atmosphere,
up where the air is clear.
Oh, let's go fly a kite.
Fly a kite.
Will you send it flying up there? All at once you'll light of that air. You can dance on the breeze over houses and trees with your fist holding tight to the string of your kite. Let's go fly a kite up to the highest height.
Let's go fly a kite and send it soaring up through the atmosphere.
Let's go fly a kite.
We should never sing again.
No.
Come now.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. One and all.